words, just to introduce you to the Pennsylvania, who have not read your program. In 2012, the New York Mycological Society celebrated its 50th anniversary in the year that John Cage's centenary happened. And so we had a show at Cooper Union. And this material today is an excerpt from that show. So, let's go. Elizabeth, it is a beautiful day. Let's take a walk. Perhaps we will find some mushrooms. If we do, we shall pluck them and eat them. Betsy Zogbaum asked Marion Thalys Gray whether she knew the difference between mushrooms and toadstools. I think I do. But consider, my dear, how dull life would be without a little uncertainty in it. Once, when Lois Long was on a mushroom walk led by Guy Nearman, a mushroom was found that was quite rare. Guy Nearman told Lois Long that it was Pleurotus masticatus. Then, walking along, Lois Long, realizing she had already forgotten the name of the mushroom, said to Guy Nearman, "I just can't get the name of that mushroom into my head. In fact, I have a terrible time remembering any of these Latin names." "When you don't know," Guy Nearing said, "the name of a mushroom, you should say it first to the person in front of you, then to the person in back of you. Soon you'll find you remember it." On his next visit, he brought me specimens of what was then generally regarded as a rare Stropharia, Stropharia rugoso annulata. This time, it was my turn to jump up and down. I had never seen such a beautiful specimen of this rare fungus. John assured me that there was a lot more like it where those came from. And how many would I like? I suggested a bushel of them as dried. Postage was cheaper than those days. Bill Williams was a regular on the night, NYMS Sunday mushroom hunts back in the 70s when he joined the club. He was the tallest guy around, and when we met at the same location time as other groups like the Sierra Club, you could always find the NYMS by looking for Bill. He had a dark mustache in those days, and it was the kind that made him look like he was about to disagree with whatever you were about to say. He developed a reputation for being somewhat of a curmudgeon, but then he knew a low threshold for absurdities. And when people talk in the woods while looking for mushrooms, they often say the most absurd things about politics and life. Bill was the unofficial club standard bearer for rational discourse. He was a polymath of sorts who seemed to be better read and more deeply knowledgeable about things intellectual than anyone I've ever met. For example, at the Museum of Natural History exhibit on Darwin, Bill proved to me that he not only knew more about Darwin than the museum, he knew more about Darwin than Darwin. If there's anything to the uniqueness of genomes, Bill's was one of a kind and quite unreplicatable. Lois Long, Esther Dam, Ralph Ferrara, and I were in the Haverstraw Cemetery gathering Tricholoma personatum. An elderly lady with a hat on, standing by while a man she was with was tending a grave, happened to notice us. She called out, asking what we were doing there. We said, "Looking for mushrooms." Her voice rose slightly as she asked whether Lois Long's Volkswagen, which was parked nearby, belonged to one of us. The next thing she asked, her voice sharp-edged, was whether we loved the ones, whether we had loved ones buried there. Hearing no one else did, she spoke firmly and loudly, "Well, I don't like it, and I don't like anyone else would like it. And if the mushrooms grow here, let them." Meanwhile, the gentleman with her paid no attention. He just went on doing what he was doing, and we, walking dutifully toward the little car, passed by quantities of our favorite mushrooms, making not the slightest attempt to pick them. As we drove off, the woman was yelling, "Get out! Get out and never come back!" On Yap Island, phosphorescent fungi are used as hair ornaments for moonlight dances. While hunting morels with Alexander Smith in the woods near Ann Arbor, I mentioned having found quantities of Bacterias deliciosus in the woods of Northern Vermont. He said, "Were the stipes viscid?" I said, "Yes, they were." He said, "It's not deliciosus, it's thionis." He went on to say that people go through their entire lives thinking that things are that when they are actually this, and that these mistakes are necessarily made with the very things with which they are most familiar. Mr. Romanoff is 60 years old. Mr. Nearing is 70 years old. Mr. Romanoff's mother is 85. On one of the mushroom field trips, a photographer came who had been sent by the New York Times. We took the Stony Brook Trail. We had no sooner gotten started than the photographer busied himself taking pictures. Soon, Mr. Romanoff was not to be seen. Mr. Nearing drew Lois Long aside and said, "Mr. Romanoff has had an accident to his pants. Would you find out whether one of the ladies has a safety pin?" Lois Long complied. A very small safety pin was found, and Lois Long gave it to Mr. Romanoff. He came back to the group. The safety pin, being so small, proved ineffective. Mr. Romanoff nevertheless gave the group, and as the walk continued, the split in his pants progressed until it was complete, crotch to cuff. We stopped for lunch in the spring. Mr. Romanoff looked at his pants and said, "My mother will hear about this." In late August, a Korean woman from Queens went to with a Korean hiking club to an area near Fonsoc State Park. She picked some mushrooms. She died several days later of liver failure. A container of cooked mushrooms was found in her refrigerator. The medical examiner's office brought them over to me to identify. Identifying mushrooms correctly requires a quite learnable skill set, but identifying cooked mushrooms is, to use a metaphor, a different kettle of fish. The cooked mushrooms appear to be a carrot, so whatever it was, it is not describing an angel. Amanita rosa, or Amanita bisporichera, or the deadly Gallinia longinalis. The mushrooms in our area, known to cause liver failure, because she was said to be a healthy person and was not believed to have swallowed a bottle of Tylenol, It seems likely that liver failure developed from eating a meal that was fried in the whole mushrooms. In those years, the early 70s, the New York Archaeological Society had Sunday walks that always included Don Nearing, the co-founder of the current NYMS, then in his 80s, who was also the master identifier of the group. Al, who served as a recorder and took over from Guy's lunchtime identifier and raconteur, Hector, who identified every plant we passed, and Esther, who collected fees from everyone, knew and everyone, and had opinions on everything. A number of others were regulars, but none as regular as Guy and the three Mycoteers. Let me show you my recent text. It is called Mushroom Book. I had for many years wanted to write a mushroom book, and I found that when I concentrated on mushrooms, it was not interesting. So what I did was to list all the things that interested me. So, mushroom stories, excerpts from Thoreau's journal about mushrooms, excerpts from Thoreau's journal about anything, remarks about life and art, or art and life, life and life, art and art. By that I mean life becoming art, and I think of Fuller. I think that there must be found a kind of common denominator between those two, like Mao rely on power, and those like Fuller who have a faith in the goodness of material having. You see, Fuller, like Mao, believes in the goodness of human nature, and he thinks that makes people bad is the fact that they do not have what they need. If they had what they needed, they would be less selfish than they are, and when they do not have what they need. I have noticed too with our Mushroom Society in New York that when the weather is dry and there are a few mushrooms, the people are very secretive and selfish and do not let anyone know what they have found. They hunt very quickly. But when the weather is very wet and there are lots of mushrooms, they become extremely unselfish and generous and give mushrooms away. I noticed too with myself that as I have what I need, I look at our large stores in New York, and I do not see anything I want. Each one of us has his own stomach. It is not the stomach of another. Lois Long likes lamb chops. Esther Dan doesn't. Ralph Ferrara prefers the way his aunt cooks mushrooms to the way anybody else does, to wit, and olive oil with garlic. As far as I'm concerned, they're cooked in butter, salt, and pepper, and that's it. Now and then, with the addition of some cream, sometimes sweet, sometimes sour, and less often, a little lemon juice. Once I followed a recipe for stuffed morels under glass. When I got around to eating them, we couldn't tell what they were tasting. The dish suggested fancy restaurants. In the summer of 1975, we were busy preparing his bicentennial commission, Apartment House 1776. He visited Albany, New York, where I lived at the time, where we worked our way through a damp, raining August work week. On Saturday, the sun reappeared, and so at my doorstep did John. He said, "We will not work today, but could we instead go someplace where large trees and unmown lawns might be found?" I knew just the place. Albany Rural Cemetery. We drove and walked its hundreds of acres, picking mushrooms as we went. For several hours, his large basket was filled with edibles, and not just the familiar ones, but Lacarias, Hygrophagus, and Lactarius, among others. Back at my apartment, John then cooked the specimen, each in their own preparation. We feasted on the afternoon's proceeds, washed down with a good jug of mothball china. After an hour or so in the woods looking for mushrooms, Dad said, "Well, we can always go and buy some more." We have the impression that we're learning nothing. But as the years pass, we recognize more and more mushrooms. And we find that the names that go with them begin to stick in our heads. Furthermore, we're still alive. However, we must be cautious. Guy Nearing sometimes says that all mushroom experts die from mushroom poisoning. Donald Malcolm finds the dangers of lion hunting largely imaginary, those of mushroom hunting perfectly real. Henry Cowell told me that years ago, in Palo Alto, two Stanford botany professors assured him that a mushroom he had found was edible. He ate it and was very ill. Realizing he had eaten other things at the same meal and believing that the teachers knew what they were talking about, he tried the mushroom not once, but twice again, becoming seriously sick each time. You could say that West Virginia is just down the road. Folks, they're welcome mushroom rangers. That's where the mushrooms are, especially when it's summer and dry up here. Down in the mountains near Elkins, it's warm in the daytime, just right for finding a swimming hole in a creek, which we did. At night, it's cool, and the night sounds include a 6-week annual summer Elkins Music Festival. Did that too. Mushrooms are jumping, that's no lie. You could just stand in the oak woods and look about and see a dozen different mushrooms looking back. If you reach down to pick one up, half a dozen more seem to peer out of nowhere. You fill your basket in no time. Of course, it is possible to be in the wrong place at the right time. To hunt in rhododendron thickets, for example. Not much there, though, nor are there that much in the pure hemlock stands either. But in the oak woods, well, that was heaven. And the music, well, it don't get no better than that. And it's just down the road from us. On another occasion, John visited me at my office, and as usual, conversation drifted to mushrooms. I had two large specimens of a giant puffball on my desk. each over a foot in diameter and in the eating stage. While he visited, John kept looking at them. So when he was ready to depart, I suggested he take both specimens along if he could use them. He tucked one under each arm and started across the campus, arousing curiosity along the way. Later, he told me that as we really enjoyed the feast, they devoured both in a single lunch period. He suddenly said, "Stop!" Great quantities were growing near the road. His name was Fletcher Pence. After hurried examination, I decided it was probably an agaricus. You filled bags and baskets. Guy near him had never seen it before. It must be a new agaricus. I decided to take it to town and serve it to friends at the party. Fortunately, no one the next day was ill. Lois took specimens to Ann Arbor. Dr. Smith immediately took down Iconius farlopiana and opened it to Stropharia rugosa. We had proven its edibility, though we did so foolishly. As he asked, we sent him, to his surprise, a bushel of dried material. When Colin Epstein found out that I was interested in mushrooms, he said, "If you find them well next spring, call me up, even if you only find one. I'll drop everything, come out and cook it." Spring came. I found two morels. I called Colin Epstein. He said, "You don't expect me to come, do you? To come all that way for two little mushrooms?" In a world where very little is ever certain, where the Boston Red Sox can rise from the dead and come back and beat the Yankees, and then go on to beat the Cardinals in the World Series. In a world where the Democrats seem to have inherited the curse of the Bambino, it's somewhat comforting to know that the mushrooms are still around. In baseball, it's wait until next year. In politics, it's wait until next time. But with mushrooms, it's just wait till the next wave. On a steamy July evening, I was preparing mushrooms for a dinner with Donna Tuchel. She mentioned that she would like to go on a mushroom hunt. I said I would call John Cage for advice. On the phone with him the following day, I put the question, "Where would you recommend I go looking for morels tomorrow?" He replied, "Go for a walk in the woods. And if you don't find any, don't worry." It is said that to be an expert on mushrooms, one must be an opportunist. If you are not one at first, you soon become so. It is the irregularity of mushroom fruiting behavior that gets you. At least, this seems to be the key to John's adventures with mushrooms. John seldom misses a chance to further his interest in these unpredictable organisms, as it witnessed the painstaking efforts to contribute to the mushroom globe. That is why I have to study and read so many books. I have about 300 such books. But authors disagree, and you have to decide who you are willing to try. Charles McElvin, who wrote in 1900 The Mushroom Bible, 1,000 American Fungi, did more for the eating of wild mushrooms than anyone else, but he must have had a very strong stomach. In France, there is an antidote against the destroying angel, that white mushroom with a ring around its stem and a cup at its base. And the only trouble is that you have to take it before you know you are sick. Later, it has no effect. There was a well-known series of French murders by mushrooms. The man who collected them was deaf and dumb. He was instructed to gather only those with rings and cups, but not all such mushrooms are poisonous. When the man who wanted the murder done went to get the insurance, there had been no death. Now, would you like more salad? And as John looked at me and laughed, his face crinkled and laughed with him. Yes, and if I say that mushrooms defy our efforts at classification, it is because I often have the opportunity to experience this. One day, during a morning walk in a forest in Vermont, I got sick after eating a mushroom that I normally ate cooked, and that raw proved to be poisonous. This particular time, I hadn't yet eaten anything that day, and the mushroom was raw. I was sick for 12 whole hours. But I was able to tell my friends not to get too. I knew it wasn't the deadly mushroom. I enrolled in a class in mushroom identification. The teacher was a PhD and the editor of a publication on mycology. One day he picked up a mushroom, gave a good deal of information about it, namely historical, and finally named the plant as Pluteus cervinus, edible. I was certain the plant was not Pluteus cervinus. Due to the attachment of the gills up to the stem, it seemed to me to be an anteloma and therefore possibly seriously poisonous. I thought, what shall I do? Point out the teacher's errors? Or, following school etiquette, saying nothing, let the other members of the class possibly poison themselves? I decided to speak. I said, I doubt whether this mushroom is Pluteus cervinus. I think it's anteloma. The teacher said, well, go pee it out. This was done. And it turned out I was right. The plant was a poisonous mushroom. The teacher came over to me and said, if you know so much about mushrooms, why don't you take this class? I said, I take this class because there's so much about mushrooms I don't know. Then I said, by the way, how is it you didn't know that you did not recognize that plant? He said, well, I specialize in jelly fungi, and I just did the flesh and fungi the world. When Vera Williams first noticed that I was interested in wild mushrooms, she told her children not to touch any of them because they were all deadly poisonous. A few days later, she bought a steak and martinis, and we decided to serve a smothered with mushrooms. when she started to cook the mushrooms, the children all stopped whatever they were doing and watched her attentively. When she served dinner, they all burst into tears. Schoenberg was approaching 60 when I became one of his students in 1933. At the time, what one did was choose between Stravinsky and Schoenberg. So, after studying for 2 years with his first American student, Adolf Weiss, I went to see him in Los Angeles. He said, "You probably can't afford my price." And I said, "You don't need to mention it because I don't have any money." So he said, "Will you devote your life to music?" And I said, "I would." And although people might feel, because I know my work is controversial, that I have not devoted myself to music utterly, that I have spent too much time with chess or with mushrooms before writing, I still think I've remained faithful. You can stay with music while you're hunting mushrooms. It's a curious idea, perhaps, but a mushroom grows for such a short time, and if you happen to come across it by a stretch, it's like coming upon a sound which also appears so short. In our mushroom society, I used to plan lectures instead of excursions and weekend field trips during the winter, because when the countryside is covered with snow, it's impossible to gather mushrooms. One of the monthly lectures I had scheduled dealt with the sexuality of mushrooms. We had invited a specialist from Connecticut who had cultivated a certain species of mushrooms, a coprinus, in very large quantities to study their sex. In his lecture, he taught us that the sexual nature of mushrooms wasn't so different from that of human beings, but it was easier to study. He explained that there were around 80 types of female mushrooms and around 180 types of males in one species alone. Some species, some combinations result in reproduction, while others do not. Female type 42, let's say, will never reproduce with male type 111, but will with certain others. That led me to the idea that our mutual male and female is an interpretation of an actual complex human state. Betty Isaacs told me that when she was in New Zealand, she was informed that none of the mushrooms growing wild there was poisonous. So one day, she decided that she noticed a hillside covered with fungi and gathered a lot and made catsup. When she finished the catsup, she tasted it and it was awful. Nevertheless, she bottled it and put it up on a high shelf. A year later, she was house cleaning and discovered the catsup, which she had forgotten about. She was on the point of throwing it away, but before doing this, she tasted it. It had changed color. Originally a dirty gray, it had become black. And, as she told me, it was divine, improving the flavor of whatever it touched. There's a street in Stony Point in a lowland near the river where a number of species of mushrooms grow abundantly. I visit the street often. A few years ago in May, I found the morel there, a choice mushroom which is rare around Rockland County. I was delighted. None of the people living on the street ever talk to me while I'm collecting mushrooms. Sometimes children come over and pick at them before I get to them. Well, the year after I found the morel, I went back in May expecting to find it again, only to discover that a cinder block house had been put up where the mushroom had been growing. As I looked at the changed land, all the people in the neighborhood came out on their porches. One of them said, "Ha ha! Your mushrooms are gone." At the New York Botanical Garden, there was a first course in mycology in 1957 and 1958 given by Donald P. Rogers. And who was in the class with John Cage and Lois Long, a friend of his, and a couple of others. We once went to his beautiful home in Stony Point, New York. Stony Point is right You could hardly find a mushroom there. There were so many stones there. I'd never seen a mushroom walk of that nature. And I came dressed in a fancy skirt and not proper shoes. And when we picked mushrooms, I brought the back of the house home. There were no chairs. We sat on the floor or on pillows. He had bought some big, wonderful breads, pumpernickels, and rye, which you tear a hump like that. And we had all the mushrooms we had collected. At John's, you don't wash the mushrooms. You just wipe the dirt off. We cooked some of them separately so we could taste what they were, and then we made a casserole of a whole bunch of them all together. We had Dr. Rogers there, who told us that we had. We were all beginners and didn't know the poisonous mushrooms, really. When we ate them with the hunks of bread and wine sitting on the floor, it was just wonderful. I had never eaten any wild mushrooms. I just gorged myself on these. The result was that I had a terrible reaction to them. I called up John afterwards and asked, "Did anyone else get sick?" He said, "No, nobody got sick. Everyone's fine." "How come I got sick?" John said. "Well, some people are more sensitive." I took a number of mushrooms to Guy Gehring and asked him to name them for me. He did. On my way home, I began to doubt whether one particular mushroom was what he had called it. When I got home, I got out my books and came to the conclusion that Guy Gehring had made a mistake. The next time I saw him, I told him about this, and he said, "There are so many Latin names rolling around in my head that sometimes the wrong one comes out." Lois Long, Christian Wolfe, and I climbed Slide Mountain, along with Guy Gehring and the Flemings, including Willie. All the way up and down the mountain, we found nothing but Calilia platyphylla. So that I began to itch to visit a cemetery in Williston, in New York, where in my mind's eye, Calilia cervinus was growing. By the time we got back to the parked cars, our knees were shaking with fatigue and the sun had gone down. Nevertheless, I managed to persuade Lois Long and Christian Wolfe to drive over to Millerton. It meant an extra 100 miles. We arrived at the cemetery at midnight. I took a flashlight out of the glove compartment, got out, and first hastily and then carefully examined all the stumps and the ground around them. There wasn't a single mushroom growing. Going back to the car, I fully expected Lois Long and Christian Wolfe to be exasperated. However, they were entranced. The aurora borealis, which neither of them had ever seen before, was playing in the northern sky. John Cage died this past August, just shy of his 80th birthday. Although he is best known as a composer of new music, he loved mushrooms. In 1958, as a mushroom expert, he won a major prize on an Italian TV quiz show. In 1962, he founded the New York Mycological Society. In 1964, he received Nannan's Award for contributions to amateur mycology. In 1972, he published with Alexander H. Smith and Lois Long a limited edition art book on mushrooms. His passion for mushrooms is our concern here, and because he wrote so widely and so well about mushrooms and much else, we think he is best served by his own words on the subject. Here, then, are some mushroom bits and pieces, some interviews, some stories, some poems, and some recipes by John Cage. David Tudor gives the impression of not being overly fond of mushrooms. But one night, he had 2 helpings of morels and then finished the dish completely, including the juice. The next afternoon, while he was shaving, read out loud the following quotation from Leonardo da Vinci. "Lo, there are some of us who call themselves nothing more than a passage for food, producers of dung, fillers of up of privies. For them, nothing appears in the world, nor is there any virtue in their work, for nothing in them remains but full privies." David Tudor said, "Perhaps they were good news." Thank you. day after I finally went to the meeting was in Italy on mushrooms. I received anonymously in the mail volume 2 of a French book on mushrooms that had been published in Germany. I was studying it in a crowded streetcar going to downtown Milan. The lady next to me said, "What are you reading that for? That's finished." One winter day, the tutor and I were touring the Middle West. From Cincinnati, we drove to Yellow Springs to drum up an engagement for Merce Cunningham and his dance company. In this way, we had met the Legarys. Keith was teaching philosophy at Antioch College, and Donna taught weaving and dancing. My conversation with McGarry had no sooner begun than we discovered our mutual interest in mushrooms. I told him that I'd never seen the winter-growing Calliva volutopes. He opened the front door and, using his flashlight, showed me the plant growing in the snow from the roots of a nearby tree. He told me what difficulty he was having finding books about fungi. I gave him my copy of Hard, which I brought along. This book deals with the Ohio mushrooms. The next day, I located 2 copies of the book in a second-hand bookstore in Columbus. I bought them both. Each winter, I find a delivery of the book in quantity. How is it I didn't notice it during the winters before I met Kathy Gary? Once, when I was in Ann Arbor with Alexander Smith, I said that one of the things I liked about botany was that it was free of the jealousies and selfish feelings that plagued the arts. That I would, for that reason, if for no other, given my life to live over again, be a botanist rather than a musician. He said, "That shows how little you know about botany." Later in the conversation, I happened to mention the name of a mycologist connected with another Midwestern university. Incisively, Smith said, "Don't mention that man's name in my house." My annual fungus walk at Greenberg Sanctuary occurred at the end of a very dry August. When I arrived, the naturalist said she hadn't seen any mushrooms coming up in weeks. My apprehension was relieved by Gary Linkoff's arrival for the walk. While I was nervous to be in this tough spot with my mentor nearby, I knew that Gary would not be an intimidator, though I knew full well he had forgotten more about mushrooms than I could ever learn. The group headed off to the woods, where, as expected, we found very little in the way of fleshy fungi. But keeping to a polyporthine talk, I managed to scrape together enough fungus, mycology, and ecology to fill the time allotted. Gary stayed in the background until the end of the walk, when he offered the group a look at Phaeocolisium polyporeum, my new black magic sticks growing on the caps of purple tube polypore trapped above the leaves had mushrooms in this mushroom walk behind me. I asked Gary as we walked out to catch the bus, "How'd I do?" "Those rolling eyes and Cheshire cat really is," he said. "Most of what you said was true." At Darmstadt, when I wasn't involved with music, I was in the woods looking for mushrooms. One day, while I was gathering some hypholomas that were growing around the stump not far from the concert, a lady secretary from the Fairy Kisafunaya Music came by and said, "After all, nature is better than art." Caesar's mushroom, we had them first in Vermont. They were given to us by a stranger. They were even more delicious when with Jab you found them at a disco. He sauteed them very gently, and at the last moment added whipped cream. It was interesting to hear you last month discuss cage and mushrooms. It reminded me of an experience in North Saskatchewan in the 1960s. Cage was the music leader of the Emma Lake Arts Workshop. I think John Alloway was the critic that year. Artists worked for 2 weeks in a large studio. I was a young artist and spent my career since then as a curator. Each day, John would lay out his finds on a table in the dining hall and label them in Latin and common names. But during an expedition, several took into the woods, far from the camp. We had a scary few hours. John, hunting for mushrooms, was left in the woods for a late pickup. But we got lost, right away we learned later, and spent the night in the woods. It was Mounties, dogs, Indian trackers, and a helicopter, grid searches, and the scary idea that this famous New York composer would not be found. We were used to New York City artists and critics coming up, but this would be not a good thing if he was down and not found. I was selected early to go with the Mountie and the tracking dog just before dark. Spent the night sleeping in the ditch to get ready for a full-scale search in the morning. He was found, of course, but it's a story I told many times when his name came up. Most people hearing that you know your mushrooms ask whether you've had any visions. Just yesterday, I received a postcard from people I've never met. They had found lots of Amanita and wanted to know how to decoct from them their powers. Am unable to help them. Some authors mention combining the mushroom with blueberry juice. None, as far as I know, gives process or quantities.